It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and you're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT, Knoxville. I'm Chrissy Kuiper. Today we are talking about keeping and caring for exotic and endangered animals. What role do zoos play in the lives of these animals, now and in the past? How do we care for their physical and mental well-being? And what are their chances for a life outside of captivity? Our guests today are Knoxville Zoo Director Lisa New and Knoxville Zoo Director of Animal Collections Phil Colclough, along with Professor Ed Ramsey from the University of Tennessee's College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you all so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Could you each introduce yourselves and tell us just a little about what you do?
I'm Lisa New, and I'm the Executive Director of Knoxville Zoo. I've had that position since May 5th of this year, and I took that position half a year of interim last year in 2013 from January.
After Jim Vilna left.
After Jim Vilna's retirement, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'm Ed Ramsey. I teach in the veterinary school with the College of Veterinary Medicine, and I've been the consulting veterinarian for the zoo for about 22 years now.
And I'm Phil Colclough, and I've been at the zoo for right at about 17 years, and I'm Director of Animal Collections and Conservation currently, the position that Lisa had before me.
Oh, okay.
Previous to that, I was curator of the herpetology department, so I've got kind of a snake slant on the whole thing.
Oh, right. And I spent some time in the herpetology department when I was there just a couple of weeks ago. First, I just want to offer condolences on the death yesterday of your lioness, Sakaya.
Yes, thank you.
She died here on campus at the College of Veterinary Medicine, right?
No, actually, she died just after she got back to her exhibit at the zoo. So they had put her back into her night house, and she was, they thought, waking up, and they were just pulled the catheter out, and she stopped breathing and passed away.
Is I read that she was 18.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a long life for a cat?
That's about right for a lion. You know, we'd hope we get our lions and tigers up into the late teens. That would be about the expected half-life or expected lifespan.
And it was a urinary tract infection that she was being treated for?
Yeah, she had blood in her urine, and we thought it was urinary tract infection. We're still trying to figure it out. The autopsy, they did a preliminary autopsy last night. And right now, I'd say we're going to have to wait until the second part of the autopsy comes back to really tell what's going on.
Gotcha. Okay. As you said, you've been pretty much the vet for the Knoxville Zoo for some time now. It seems like we'd be kind of spoiled in Knoxville, not just to have the zoo facility as it is and how much it's grown over the last several years especially, but to have the vet school here so close by. I'm assuming that doesn't happen very often for a lot of facilities around the country.
Yeah, there's probably about 5 zoos that have vet schools nearby, so we're not unique. We're probably the largest zoo and certainly the one with the longest history of the relationship. And so from that standpoint, we are unusual.
And I'd say for a zoo our size, we have the quality of vet care and the access to resources that we have compared to another zoo that didn't have that partnership. Well beyond our budget capacities, just this wonderful relationship and access to all of the veterinarians through Dr. Ramsey and Dr. Schumacher.
Yeah, I should point out that, you know, I'm only kind of part of the team, and there's a big team, and it includes Dr. Jürgen Schumacher, my partner, who's out there about half the time, and I'm out there half the time, and then also we have residents that come through and stay 3 years with us and then go on from there.
And they do a rotation. Some of them do a rotation in the zoo. Is that right?
Well, the students do. The students, senior students, can do that. Rotate out with us on a kind of daily basis. They do that on a 2-week blocks. But actually, the residents are graduate veterinarians that have come here for specialized training, and so they stay with us for 3 years. And then we've had people that have come out of our program are at the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., and the Portland Zoo in Detroit, Tulsa, Dallas, Los Angeles, Bronx. We have people all over the country now.
Right. Phil, does having a medical facility close by influence the kind of animals that the zoo has?
As far as, does it dictate our collection?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that. I don't think so. Lisa, I mean, it mirrors that of any other zoo that doesn't have, that doesn't have that relationship. It's, as Ed said, it's a fantastic relationship that goes both ways. I mean, I'd like to think that we benefit the vet school as well. But it's a fantastic program.
How do you decide what animals to have?
Well, a lot of it is dictated by budget and by space, interest of keeper staff for sure.
Collection planning.
Yeah, the collection plan that we're in the midst of right now. We have to go through an accreditation process every 5 years, and we have to show a collection plan that gives rhyme and reason to the collection we have and plans for space throughout the zoo, where they're going to put the animals, where we're planning on putting new animals or keeping the collection that we have, how it fits into the overall plan.
So if we're going to make a decision, if we have a space for a new habitat or a habitat space opens up, then what we would do is think, well, what species are appropriate for that habitat? And then, we look to the population in North America, what we have in other zoos. And is there a program with that? Is what's the conservation value? How can we, in what way can we participate? And so all of that factors into that collection plan in determining what species we'll have or not.
It's way beyond, hey, that would be cool.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole lot that goes into it, as Lisa said. It's got to have impact on the whole population, AZA-wide. I mean, we coordinate with them through SSPs to be sure we're working with the appropriate animals, too.
So it's not just about bringing in the animals that might bring the people in. It's about working with all the other zoos.
Yeah, and certainly an animal's value or its interest by our guests is one factor that we weigh in that collection plan, in our decision tree, and its habitat or value in that way. It's weighed against all of those other factors. So, a couple of acronyms that Phil said that we should talk about is AZA, and that's the Association of Zoos and Aquariums, and that's our accrediting body, and there's 225 accredited institutions out of about 2,500 licensed animal exhibitors in the United States. And then SSPs, of course, is Species Survival Plans. So those are programs that are managing one species, one population, as if they are, in a lot of ways, a wild population. So instead of Knoxville Zoo having 9 red pandas or 100 red pandas or whatever we have at the moment, there's 300 in the population at 60 zoos, and we manage them as one genetic population.
When you say conservation value, what do you mean?
Well, what I mean is, are they endangered? Are they threatened? Status is probably the better term for that.
Okay. Status in the wild.
Yeah, status in the wild.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Let's go ahead and open up the phone lines, 974-5500. That's 974-5500. We're talking about exotic and endangered animals, especially with regards to the Knoxville Zoo. And we also have Ed Ramsey here from the UT College of Veterinary Medicine to talk about physical and mental well-being. I guess it's a lot easier to determine an animal being physically ill. How do you determine their mental well-being?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is, we're like a whole team. Health team at the zoo. The veterinarian's part of the team, and then if it comes to making decisions about antibiotics or surgery, then we're the ones that do that. But all the keepers, all the curators are all together to try to manage the health of these animals, and especially when you're talking about, let's say, mental well-being, whether they're happy, welfare, that's really the team effort. And that goes from the keepers doing enrichment and them assessing the animals. They're much more astute. So I come in, they work with the animals constantly. I come in and look at it for 10 or 15 minutes. I'm not going to say, he looks bad. I depend on the keepers. The keepers are my hands and my eyes in the collection, and they're the people that really know what's going on with those animals. And then we take that information and we try and mull it around and try to come up with what's the best solution if there is a problem. Most of the time there isn't a problem, and part of that is the type of animals you select. We have selected for animals that do well in captivity as opposed to animals that are high strung and maybe don't do well in captivity.
Can you give us an example of some of those
animals? Well, there's a number of species that just it's difficult to meet their dietary requirements. Three-toed sloths. You won't see any three-toed sloths in captivity, and it's because nobody knows how to feed them very well. And then there's some of the animals. You don't see many nocturnal animals in zoo exhibits because, in fact, they like to curl up in the daytime and go into the back exhibit and lay down, and so those are not animals that actually, they may do fine at night, but they don't make good exhibit animals, so those are animals that we don't see. There's some species of antelope that are really quite high-strung and difficult to keep in captivity, and so you won't see a bushbuck in any collection in North America because it's very difficult to keep bushbuck alive.
Yeah.
And they bang around. They run into fences. So in some, our water buck do just fine. On the other hand, they're perfectly happy to be with us.
And dietary requirements might dictate some of that, too. And once again, I'm taking a little bit of a reptile slant on some of this, too, but there's species of lizards that only eat a certain species of ant that might only occur in one county in Texas. obviously that's not something you're going to keep in captivity. Or you may have a tortoise that only eats fungus. And we do have some tortoise species that have a fungivore diet, I guess, is what it would be called.
And we have one that eats only durian fruit?
Well, we supplement it with durian for sure, but yeah, if you know what that is, are you familiar with the durian?
I went to Thailand a couple of years ago and unfortunately did try the durian fruit, yeah.
I read an article today that said they are just allowing durian into UK as of today.
Really?
So, yeah, so maybe their turtle diets were...
I guess people are opening their minds. Well, I would think, though, that some of those animals that are not very good exhibit animals are some of the ones in the wild that need the most help.
That may or may not be the case necessarily. It's like Ed said, the nocturnal animals, if you don't have a nocturnal house with, the light cycles reversed where they would be good to be on display. They may not be the best in terms of guest experience value, but their conservation status, it may or may not be impacted by that. Some of the, most endangered animals in the world are in zoos and thriving, gorillas, chimpanzees, and some of the rhino species that great work's being done with, and reptiles as well. So, yeah, it's not necessarily always the case.
And that works hand in hand with our exhibit design team. And we've got an in-house exhibit design team, which is also pretty pretty unusual for a zoo. And Shane Chester, who's our director of exhibits. I mean, Shane, what's his title?
Director of operations.
Director of operations. My peer. Sorry, Shane, if you're listening. He's great, and he looks at the natural history and talks to the keepers about what needs to be done. So like the naked mole rats we got famous for. It's a fossorial species. They live underground all the time. How are you going to exhibit that? Turns out clear acrylic tubes work really well. They just need the physical to feel around them, and you can exhibit them through clear acrylic tubes or half burrows pushed up against glass. So there's a lot of creative ways you can work exhibits to make maybe not so easily exhibited animals exhibitable.
And I guess a lot of zoos, like you all do, you have an off exhibit area for some of the species that you have in your breeding programs that are not on exhibit.
We try to have that in all of our design. We as animal people would always want more, but there's always a need to pull an animal off of habitat, whether it's a lion or a cat that's had cubs and she needs some private time, whether you have an animal that might be sick, or if you're holding animals and sometimes the number of animals you have exceeds necessarily your habitat space, so animals may rotate through. They'll have some time off exhibit and they'll be in private yards, and then they'll come out at different times of the day. So right now we have several gorillas in a couple of actually sometimes three groups. So they are moving all day long. You know, they're out on exhibit some, they come into the bedroom some, they move through the back areas, the front areas. And we do that also just to help, you know, keep things exciting for them. Mm-hmm. So they're moving all day long.
Let's take a call. We have a call from Rose. And incidentally, if you have a question or a comment, please call 974-5050. Rose, are you there?
Yes, this is Rose Shelton, Knoxville. I had a question either for Dr. Ramsey or Lisa New. I was wondering if they keep anecdotal records on these zoo animals, and if they are dialoguing with their observation is on their health and happiness, and you know the food they eat, and what records they keep on the animals on a day to day basis.
Oh, okay, that's an interesting question. Thanks for the call, Rose.
Actually, our records are very central and key to everything we do. So we have records on all of our animals. They all have a file. Some of them are very thick. Some of the primates, the elephants, you know, that have long lives. We have medical records, and when the veterinarians go out on rounds, they'll come back and write their notes related to whatever case in particular that we have. And then we also have records just on their daily care and their behavior. All of those things we track. And we also have that in multiple places so that if we have a catastrophe or something happens, that those records are preserved. And in a lot of ways, we share that nationally, even internationally, through an internet-based program called ZIMS, which is Zoological Information Management System. And it's
like a medical information
share. Yeah, it's not just medical, though. It's really all-inclusive, and it's nice because you can, as an animal manager, you can say, well, how many aardvarks are there in North America, and where are they? It's one of our collection planning tools, so we can pull that up. Oh, they're in this many zoos, these are the programs, these are the subspecies, and then an animal's record can also move and stay consistent across institutions. So if it leaves Knoxville, its records will go with it.
And it's real usable in-house, too. Say if you have an animal, once again, I'm going back to the reptile thing a little bit, but some reptiles will fast seasonally. And, instead of panicking, look at their record and say, hey, last December they were doing the same thing for this many weeks. And it's not unusual for this to be happening. So behaviorally, we keep records, too, on most everything.
Ed, do you participate in that as well?
Well, on the medical record side, so a lot of our animals, some of our, the gorillas and elephants that live to be 30 and 40 years old, they have much thicker medical records than I do. And when we transfer them from zoo to zoo, it always amuses me. I get these folders that feel like small phone books that I have to read through of, because these guys, most of our animals get annual medical exams and blood work, especially individuals like gorillas and chimps. So there's actually very extensive medical records. From a behavioral observation standpoint, we kind of rely on the keeper records to handle those type of things, because again, they're the people that are there working with the animal day to day.
Yeah.
You know, we have an animal that has a rocking behavior that he developed when he was quite young. We saw that when he came to Knoxville, and then we traced and talked to the zoos that he was housed, you know, prior. Is this something new? Is it? And, you know, through those records, we were able to determine, no, this is something that he developed, you know, early in his infancy that he's carried on through. It's not something new, you know, that happened when he came to Knoxville. So records are really, really important to us.
Yeah, I'm sure that was a load off to know that information, too, that it wasn't, you know, a trauma for him to show up at the zoo. And
right, because, that wasn't one of the key points in his transfer. It was just something the last institution, you know, and I don't want to say took for granted. It's just part of his behavioral repertoire. And so, yeah, we were able to trace that back and trace all the way to when it started.
Let's take a real quick break. You are listening to Dialogue here on WUOT, Knoxville 91.9 FM. My guests today are Lisa New and Phil Colcliffe of the Knoxville Zoo and Ed Ramsey of the UT College of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question or a comment, please call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. This is WUOT.
Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney. On the next To The Point, a Super Bowl commercial featuring Scarlett Johansson focused popular attention on an international issue, the long-running movement to boycott Israel. Is economic pressure a new form of leverage to push Israel toward peace talks with the Palestinians? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
Coming your way this afternoon at 2 on WUOT2.
You are listening to Dialogue on WUOT Knoxville 91.9 FM. I'm Chrissy Kuiper with Lisa New and Phil Colcliffe of the Knoxville Zoo and Ed Ramsey of the UT College of Veterinary Medicine. You have a question or a comment, please call us at 974-5050, 974-5050. We've done a couple of features just in the last week about the species survival plans at the zoo, so I want to ask you about those. You have quite a number of animals at the Knoxville Zoo that are under these plans, which of course I learned from the keepers while I was there, that you're required to participate in for accreditation with the AZA. Can you tell us a little bit about those programs and who's involved?
Well, we have about 46, 47, I think, species survival plans that we work with. And that is our Association of Zoos and Aquariums. They're really cornerstone for conservation efforts. So like the example I gave with the red pandas, instead of Knoxville having, you know, a handful of red pandas and breeding those pandas to each other, and as you can imagine, that line would become more and more inbred across time, less genetically diverse. The North American red panda population may be, you know, 200, 300 individuals. We know all of their lineages through animal records, or many of them. And so with the population biologists, we are able to work and make genetic pairings. So species survival plans deal with one species, and they work on that population's genetic and demographic status over not just today or 5 years, but, you know, we're looking sometimes 100 and 200 years out.
Oh, wow. Really? Is that easier to do with animals that are long-lived, like the reptiles? Or is it, I mean, can you do that with the red pandas who have kind of a short breeding window?
You know, red pandas are actually, to me, the perfect SSP animal because they have a distinct breeding season. so you can, you know, do your planning in the summer, move them in the fall. They have their cycle in the winter, and they cub in the early summer, late spring. They fit in a dog kennel, you know, so they are solitary in the wild. So all of those things make red pandas really a great model for species survival plans, as opposed to, for instance, I'll say elephants, you know, where if you pulled an elephant out of a herd structure, that might create a problem with the social dynamics. They're large, they're expensive to move. And so, you know, that makes not the SSP obsolete, but definitely more complicated in how it works.
And I guess restricted to certain facilities.
Yeah, to the facilities that can handle it. To me, probably the most difficult SSP would be the Partula snail, which we don't have here, but it's gender changes. So how do you track that in terms of breeding recommendations?
Yeah. Imagine that registrar's job.
Yeah.
That brings up a whole other question, but we don't have time for...
That's the depth of my knowledge on the Partula snails.
That's very interesting. Phil, something that came up when I was at the zoo a couple of weeks ago was that it's kind of hard to get a lot of visitors really, really excited about reptiles opposed to mammals.
I'd argue what you mean by the word excitement. Honestly, I mean, I've
well,
said,
you and Mike are excited.
No, I mean, I think it's kind of funny. Reptiles at the zoo, if And I've said this a thousand times, snakes in particular. If you hate snakes, you come and look at them. If you love snakes, you come and look at them. If you don't particularly like zebras, my guess is you walk by zebras. So, I mean, there's things. There's certain animals when people come into collections that they want to see, especially in the herp department. They want to see something big. They want to see something colorful, and they want to see something really, really dangerous. And a lot of times that doesn't necessarily fit into the animal that needs to be worked with. There might be a little brown turtle or a little brown lizard or a little brown salamander from a conservation standpoint is incredibly important. That doesn't mean they shouldn't be exhibited or kept in the collection, because I think there are ways, especially in this world of modern exhibitry and modern zoos, that you can make them interesting. You can support it with technology and graphics and hands-on. A lot of reptiles you can come out and physically show visitors. I mean, they can put their hands on, and that's just not a reptile thing, but yeah, I mean, so you struggle to make those things appealing, but there's ways to do it for sure.
Mm. Ed, what is your specialty as far as animals go?
Ooh, I really don't have a specialty. I do just about everything. I've done a lot of bear research. Red pandas, I'm the veterinary advisor, was the veterinary advisor for the Red Panda Group. I've done a lot of great ape work. I did some research on snakes, marmosets. I help consult on, we take care of a large cat sanctuary, so about 50% of my practice is lions and tigers. So pretty much cover the spectrum.
He has extensive experience with elephants, too.
Does that make you rare among veterinarians?
Oh, he's rare.
Well, yeah. He is a rare specimen. It's true.
Clearly. No, I think zoo veterinarians, the zoo field has one of the things, it's a very good field if you have a very short attention span, because then you can just do one thing and then go someplace else and do something else. So, but zoo veterinarians, I think, kind of by nature, like to do a whole variety of things. And so very few of us have chosen to specialize. So even if you went to a very large park like the Bronx Zoo or the San Diego Zoo, there may be somebody that's a little more interested in reptiles than the other person, but everybody still would go down to the reptile house. And the same for the rest of the collection.
Right.
So, I started out as actually an elephant keeper before I got into veterinary school. So elephants are a long-term favorite species.
You know, I would say that another reason that having UT as our partner is so important is because, you know, most zoo veterinarians are generalists, and so Ed, you know, is our filter really to the university, but then through him, you know, we can have access to cardiologists, to nutritionists, behaviorists, I mean, just, you know, any specialty that you can think of, we can channel through Ed to that program, but he does that first assessment.
We're the primary care, and one of the things, because of the length, the vet school has been, the zoo's been a client of the vet school since the vet school was started.
Right.
And so while some of the new people haven't had an opportunity yet, anybody that's been there for 10 years has worked on a zoo animal. And, I mean, almost throughout the entire hospital. And they've all been incredibly supportive. They look forward to helping out on those animals.
Are there specialties that are now available at the vet school that are there now as a result of the zoo?
No, it's kind of pretty much the other way around. I mean, the specialties are traditional veterinary specialties: surgery, ophthalmology, dermatology, etc. Mm-hmm. We're probably the one that's there because of the zoo, or vice versa.
When I was there, I went back to see the. At the zoo when I was there, went back to see the chimp group, mm-hmm. and wore a mask because, of course, they can catch the flu, they can catch mm-hmm. other diseases from us. Are there a lot of instances of that, of humans sharing diseases with other animals, particularly exotic animals?
The diseases going from people to animals is rarer than animals to people. But flu is an excellent example. We actually think that one of our bears came down with human flu about a week ago, maybe two bears, actually. That's very interesting. That's the first time we've ever seen that. But certainly when you're working with the great apes, if you can get it, they can get it. It's almost a rule.
What about other animals?
You can get flu. Ferrets can get the human flu, but and certainly pigs. Although we don't keep that many pigs in the collection, but anthropnoses, that is to say, diseases going from people to animals, is really pretty rare outside of those kind of examples.
Oh, okay. So they're not becoming more common.
No, I think the big concern in veterinary medicine is the number of zoonotic diseases. Those are diseases that animals can give to people. And many of them are categorized as emerging diseases, which is either they've been poorly recognized in the past or they seem to be increasing in frequency. The most famous would be rabies, is a zoonotic disease.
Are there examples of that from the zoo?
In the zoo business, we try to keep our animals healthy enough that they don't give us problems. The only one that I can think of in the last few years is I got ringworm from one of the tigers.
Okay. I guess as treatment, I mean, as the conditions go, that it could be a lot worse.
And it's pretty difficult. Most cases, you have to do something really, really stupid to catch a disease from that. I mean, you got to wash. You're just not washing your hands.
Basic hygiene. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, basic hygiene. You can eliminate most of that. And, you know.
Wash your hands. Wash your hands. Wash your hands. Mm-hmm. It's our mantra. And smile, smile, smile.
Back to the species survival plans for just a minute. You said, of course, that the red pandas have been really, really successful. What are the other success stories that you've seen?
Well, when our rhino herd was younger, we had a very successful rhino program. They're now in their upper 40s and obviously are slowing down, and we have a new breeding pair that's coming up behind them. So we've done really well with them. Lions, we've had 47 lions that have been born at the zoo. But in particular, I would say the great majority of our conservation and breeding success has come in the reptile area. So we've had we have the ninth largest collection of reptiles in the country, and so we're very proud of that. And some species that have never been bred before anywhere have been bred in our collection. So I don't know if Phil wants to talk about that a little more.
Well, and some of that actually comes from the sizes of the animals too. I mean, you know, we can have 450, 500, 600 animals in the reptile collection. You obviously can't have that with elephants.
Right.
We've kind of got the luxury of numbers in a lot of cases in the herp department. And a lot of the success with a lot of these animals are championed by somebody that has a really specific interest in that particular animal. And you met Michael, our curator of the herp department. He's a tortoise guy, and beyond that, he's a Malagasy tortoise guy. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see that our collection reflects that, and that happens to be the some of the rarest tortoise species in the whole world. He just kind of has a knack for it. He has a knack for doing it and has an eye for what they need and how they're doing. And so that's where a lot of that success has come from our tortoise program. I'd argue it's probably one of the most successful, at least probably the top two or three tortoise collections, and maybe in the world.
It sounded like it when I was there. I mean, just the very existence of those four Madagascar tortoises that you have.
The plowshare tortoises,
species.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have John on the line from Clinton. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What's your question?
Hi. We've got a farm here just north of Clinton in Anderson County, and mostly a place for kids to come. And we have llamas and alpacas and some mini donkeys and horses and et cetera. And I'm concerned, as most animal people are, with providing the best quality of life for the animals. And I just wondered if there was any good way for non-zoo people to learn about some of the things that that are known in the and learned in the zoo by the zoo community, share that knowledge and learn from them.
Great question. Thanks for the call.
I would argue we're a resource for the community for that. I mean, I think the deal with animal people is animal people love to talk about their animals. I mean, if there's anything they love to do more than anything is share their knowledge, and especially when it comes to husbandry. So our switchboard might light up this week after I say this, but I mean, most staff are more than willing to talk. If you have specific questions to people in the community that have questions, we do it every day. Or if they're just interested in something that they don't have. I mean, if they're interested in the way we care for something they obviously wouldn't have in their farm, then we'd be happy to talk about that too. So yeah, use us as a resource for that.
You know, the other place to look is actually the internet and Gopher Ag Extension publication. Certainly if you're looking at domestic animals, which includes llamas and alpacas, there are a lot of agriculture extension publications that cover everything, not just health. They actually cover husbandry, diet, and even things that we would say would get into enrichment. So looking at agriculture extension publications would be the other direction to go.
As far as education goes, you guys have a lot of education programs at the zoo. Are they geared for everybody, or are these mostly for kids?
You know, we have a few things that are geared toward adults, so that's definitely an area we would like to see grow. But most of our educational programming is for kids, and we do on-site programming. Obviously, Zoo Camp is one of our most popular. Even through the winter, we're running programs for toddlers and story times and things like that. Bedtime with the Beast, you know, so we have overnight programs and homeschool classes. But we'll also come through our outreach program, bring our ambassador animals and come to your school or your community event. And you can, there's a menu of options based on, you know, if you have certain education state requirements you're trying to meet by having us come, meeting certain curricula points, we can do that. We can create a program based on what your needs are.
What do adults want as far as education outreach from the zoo?
Well, we've had some fun classes that we've done for instance, Valentine's Day, where we talk about animal sex. And you would be surprised the number of people that are interested in that.
Not really.
You know, yeah, well, that's true. That was a stupid thing to say. But also, our grounds are quite lovely. And horticulture, and we get a lot of questions about what plants are these and how do you care for them. And, you know, I would say some of the most beautiful wreaths from materials on grounds I've ever seen. So setting up classes like that are things we would like to do in the future. And then having curatorial lecture series for people that are interested in animal conservation. So that's not so much a program that we do on site, but all of the curators and staff are out in the community. Phil was at the vet school, I believe, a month or so ago, given a presentation to one of their clubs there. So, it's really limitless. And if there's animals or plants, we can talk about it.
And even on zoo grounds itself, I mean, in the summer, for sure, we do keeper chats. We have we'll go out a lot of times with an animal hands-on and let the public ask whatever questions they want to know about it, and just make our staff available to the general public for any kind of questions. I mean, it's not a scripted dialogue that we go out and just talk, but it's there to interact with our visitors and make sure they're learning what they want to learn while they're there too, short of just reading graphics or looking at the animals themselves.
Yeah,
and we really try to not hire staff if they are not interested in also being an educator. So interacting with the public and answering their questions and being there for to help make that connection is something that we look at when we're interviewing.
Ed, you mentioned that there are sources on the internet for ag extension and places where people can find information. Is there a service available through the vet school that they can tap into? I mean, to talk to a person?
Well,
when they have questions?
Veterinary school, not precisely. So the veterinary school typically will, you know, interacts with individuals on a referral basis in the small animal clinic. So actually you would go talk to your regular veterinarian, and if you had a problem that needed more sophisticated care, that person would hopefully refer them to us, and then we would deal with them. The exotic animal clinic, we have an avian and zoological medicine service, which takes care of exotic pets. Many of those animals are actually domestic animals, like rabbits and ferrets. And so we take – those are primary care animals. And we're happy to answer questions, but we're really, you know, we'd like to focus on the – we focus pretty much on the medicine stuff so that we don't end up being Wikipedia for ferret owners. So if – and people can make appointments if they have sick animals and bring them in, and we're happy to work with them on a individual animal basis that way.
974-5050, 974-5050. Let's take another real short break. Our guests today for Dialogue are Lisa New and Phil Colcliffe from the Knoxville Zoo, and Ed Ramsey from the University of Tennessee College of Veterinary Medicine. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 974-5050. You're listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT, Knoxville.
In Pakistan, the Bhutto family represents generations of prime ministers who have been killed. Now 25-year-old Bilawal Bhutto Zardari steps into politics.
The very forces that people are scared of in this country assassinated my mother. I'm not scared of them. I want to defeat them.
The heir to the Bhutto dynasty, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join your host, Brandon Hollingsworth, for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4 o'clock on WUOT.
You are listening to Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT, Knoxville. I'm Chrissy Kuiper with Lisa New and Phil Colcliffe of the Knoxville Zoo and Ed Ramsey of the UT College of Veterinary Medicine. We're talking about endangered and exotic animals, about keeping them, caring for them, treating them when they are ill. And this has been a really interesting show. We have one call right now, Sam from Knoxville. Sam, are you there?
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's your question?
I guess it's a two-part question. I know with labs, they're prone to tear their meniscus and ACLs and so on and so forth. Do exotic animals have that same issue, big lions and zebras? And do you guys do physical surgery on those animals to repair those damaged ligaments, and et cetera?
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think I've only seen one damaged ACL, and that was actually in a gorilla back when I was a veterinarian at the Oklahoma City Zoo. So ruptured anterior cruciate ligaments, not very common in zoo animals. It does happen in domestic animals. It happens fairly frequently in dogs. And so do we do a lot of repair? No. We don't do a lot of orthopedic surgery, somewhat fortunately. In fact, I would say, generally speaking, most people think we do a lot more surgery than we do. We very, very seldom do surgery, and that's because we really limit the type of things that would, you know, an animal would get surgery for in a domestic situation, such as being hit by a car. And we also limit the number of things that we would do, such as spaying and neutering. Well, most of the time when we do contraception, it isn't something that we do permanently. So surgery isn't a big part of our practice. Certainly if we need it, we had a chimp that broke all the bones in her hands one day. We actually use our orthopedic surgeons at the vet school. And Dr. Weigel put 4 plates into that chimpanzee's hand, and she's doing great now.
Ouch.
A lot of things like, when you're looking at an injury or if it were a domestic animal or a pet, we would have surgery. But, for instance, with a lab, you know, you can take your lab out. You can walk your lab with a towel and get it in and out. You can't do that with a lion. So when we as a team are planning a strategy for an animal who's injured or sick or hurt, it's post-op care is very much part of that conversation as anything else. It's a, once we are finished, then what? Because there comes a point when that animal's anesthesia is wearing off that we no longer go in with it. It's not safe to do that. And so all that has to factor in, you know, to what we're able to do. So preventative is all the more important.
I guess you said that dogs get them those ACL injuries a lot more often. Is that a breeding thing, or is it just that, as you say, there are just more opportunities for them to be injured?
It's probably both. I mean, I think there's probably breed dispositions. I'm not the best person to talk about that. But actually, if you think how many dogs are out there and you think how many gorillas are out there, there are probably about 15,000 more dogs in Knoxville than there are gorillas. So the odds are going to be a lot better for the dogs.
You know, but there's things, too, with, for instance, gorillas that gorillas are prone to, you know, red pandas. Red pandas are, when they're young cubs, they're prone to ringworm if they are in a very moist climate that can get very, very serious. So it's something that we watch and look out for. You know, gorillas, especially males, can be prone to heart disease. And so that's something that we watch and monitor. You know, there's it's just a fluke sort of thing, but because we zoos all share information, you know, you have a gorilla that has a swollen tongue and it's really swollen over several days, and you start talking to other places and she gouged herself eating bamboo and there was an infection, and then you find out that, oh, Timmy at Louisville did the same thing, and oh my gosh, you know, Kahala at San Diego has the same problem. And because of that network, we're able to share that information quickly and help get to the source of the problem sometimes, where you might, if you were acting in isolation, you know, you wouldn't be able to act that quickly.
Let's take one more call. We have Ann on the line from Knoxville. Ann, are you there?
Yes, hi. It's Ann Vieira from the Pendergrass Agriculture Veterinary Medicine Library. I'm Dr. Ramsey's librarian, and I'm calling if the caller from Clinton is still listening, if he wanted to follow up with me on finding those extension publications that Dr. Ramsey mentioned. I can be reached at 974-9015.
Thank you, Ann. That's very nice of you.
Dr. Ramsey is a terrific library user, by the way. And I also am calling with a fond remembrance, in addition to the wonderful work by the keepers, keeping animals healthy, and the great reproduction record that the zoo has had. I think, isn't it true, the first African elephant conceived in captivity, was that Knoxville Zoo?
In the Western Hemisphere, yeah.
I also remember quite fondly the boo at the zoo circa 1987 was one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. Featured the thing handing out candy, a lady being buried alive up by where the otters are now, a monster dancing the monster mash.
Those were the good old days.
The old train with the screaming whistle and dummies run over. Oh, and then the best thing was three dummies on a bench by the old elephant exhibit, but one of the dummies was a real person, so people would walk by them in the dark, and then the real dummy would leap up and scare the daylights out of us. So it's a whole different boo at the zoo now, but it was one of the best things I've ever seen.
Nice. Thanks for the call, Ann.
Thank you.
Y'all really should use that old track more. The old train track. That could really come in handy for some Halloween shenanigans.
Our boo at the zoo now is, you know, focuses on being oh so merry and not too scary for the little ones. But we still have the monster mash for sure.
Well, let's talk for just a few. We just have a few minutes left. In fact, 4 minutes left. So let's talk just a little bit about really what is going to happen to a lot of these animals who are being bred. Will they spend the rest of their lives in captivity, or will they go back to the wild? Will there be wild for them to return to?
There's definitely some that there won't be wild to come back to. You know, the whole premise of the SSP to begin with in, 81, I think, was when the SSP program started, was kind of a living ark. I mean, kind of a repository to hold these genetics until they could go back into the wild. And you know, that's a pie-in-the-sky dream, and I think in some cases that can happen. Conservation is so beyond just putting the animal back where it belongs. I mean, there's cultural parameters you have to deal with. I mean, if you're talking about like traditional medicinal uses of some of these animals that you're dealing, you know, thousands and thousands of years of tradition that you're trying to deprogram in a matter of 15, 20 years before they're all gone. I mean, so there's a whole education component, the whole cultural component. You know, our my curator of herpetology went to Madagascar with working with tortoises, and part of that whole component was they help fund supplies for a school there, you know, to let them know that there's more to their interest in their country than just these tortoises sometimes. So, I mean, there's a whole lot to that.
There are animals that have through 25 species that through the work of our association have come back from extinction. The California condor is a great example. They're back in the wild now through our efforts, and they're the black-footed ferret, Arabian oryx, red wolves. There are 14 red wolves, you know, and now they're back in the wild. That doesn't mean that you know, number 1572 at Knoxville Zoo is going to go back in the wild. We don't necessarily look at individuals. We're looking at the population. And so an animal that is habituated to humans and is trained to do those things we need it to do to take care of it isn't the best candidate. If its genes are important for reintroduction, then that might be a different strategy for how we work and manage that animal so that its offspring can be reintroduced, if that makes sense.
It does. You also mentioned that there are some domestic species that we don't think of as being endangered.
Yeah.
What are some
of
those?
You know, it's one of my favorite topics, and it's minor breeds and domestic animals that were, you know, they've been genetically bred out because they're not good for agricultural production or for whatever reason, but their ancestors are a different breed, a hardier breed. So our most famous example is Narragansett turkeys. And so, you know, these are turkeys. There's 1,000 or so left around. So their breed is in danger of going away. They're beautiful turkey. They look like, you know, your typical Thanksgiving turkey. But there's an actual program for working with those. And interestingly, you know, the folks that work with them are not opposed to them, you know, being what other domestic farm animals become, which is food, because that is keeping that breed alive. It's keeping keeping that animal around and a need for it. And a lot of times they can be very hardy in other ways, but they're not good for domestic production. And Ed has quite a few even on his farm.
Of the turkeys?
Well, got a few, breeds.
Got
yeah.
a few turkeys oh, okay. and some other animals. I think, you know, the minor breeds are probably the easiest analogy is heritage seeds. When you go to the farmer's market and you see heritage seeds, and they're varieties of plants, and in this case animals, that are, you know, aren't being used for production agriculture, but are still interesting genetically and may have things to offer us currently and down the road.
And so when we're going to decide if we want to hold a domestic animal, for instance, in our contact yard, to hold one that is a heritage breed, an heirloom, if you want to think of it that way, gives some purpose to what you're doing, and you're still keeping that historically significant animal around for the story that it can tell.